Welcome to Unraveling Midlife. I'm your host, Sarah Spence. Thanks for joining me as I explore my own astrological midlife by speaking with all sorts of inspiring people about their life and work. If you're new to the show, welcome. Astrological midlife relates to Western astrology transits that run from the mid-30s to the mid-40s for everyone. Each of the main midlife transits have an overall theme, though details vary by generation and by individual. Directly corresponds to the term midlife crisis, though I like to call it the midlife unraveling. There are links to more information about these in the show notes, though today's guest weighs in with his perspective too. Christopher Jones is a master hand reader, the art of which is called chirology. He's also an astrologer and has a passion for outing cults and educating people about them. This is because he has experience being in one and shutting it down. Christopher is so passionate that he's been thrown out of Facebook groups for making people uncomfortable with information about cult behaviour that, I assume, threatens their view or their business. He is shrewd, intelligent, and there is a lot of information in this long podcast, with links to references, which are excellent, in the show notes. As you'll hear, #MeToo made an impact, but there's still work to do in our communities. Warning. After the first 20 or 30 minutes of this episode, there is some content that may be triggering.
Christopher Jones, welcome to Unraveling Midlife. It's great to have you here, and I've been keen to hear a little bit about you and all the things that we had a little chat about, what we might talk about today.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. Thanks for inviting me on. Yeah, you're right. This has been a promised conversation for a long time. I mean, we've known each other a year or so, 2 years maybe. We've had various conversations on the way, and it's a great privilege and to be on your podcast. So thank you for inviting me.
So, I mean, if I was to describe you like I did in the intro, you're a Buddhist hand reader and astrologer and other things as well. Do you want to tell us a bit about what you do?
My main focus of my work at the moment is on hand reading. So I've been a professional hand reader since 1984. I actually started hand reading in 1983, and then my teacher said, "You can start teaching now, so teach this lot." So I've actually been teaching hand reading since 1984. And I was a full-time hand reader in the UK for 17 years. That was my main source of income. I was part of a group called the Chirological Society, which is actually a very old society. It was founded in 1889 and revived again in the 70s to promote the study of hand reading as a serious diagnostic art, as opposed to fortune telling or palmistry or predicting the future. And I became the secretary of that organization, and I ran it for 10 years between 1989 and 1999. And I was the main journal writer, the main researcher. I wrote 15 books. I taught hundreds and hundreds of people. And in fact, I taught people back in the 1980s and 1990s who've had 30-year careers as professional hand readers in the interim period. So, but to emphasize the word Buddhist in the way that you presented it, is important because the primary orientation that we take in studying the hand is to look at how human beings create and maintain the patterns of suffering within their life. So the hand isn't a fixed thing. There are some features of the hand which don't change, like the fingerprint patterns. Everybody knows everybody has a unique set of fingerprint patterns. And these have genetic significance, or if you like, karmic significance. And the medical literature on fingerprint patterns has been studied for over 100 years. So you can look at something like fingerprint patterns and you can see the genetic disposition towards various disease conditions. And that's a whole body of knowledge called medical dermatoglyphics, which we incorporate into the approach of hand reading that we take, because our emphasis is upon understanding how people suffer and what can we do about that. So there's a very simple physical, medical, if you like, aspect to hand reading. For example, I was at a festival on the weekend, and the first woman that came to me, 57-year-old woman with incredibly bright red palms, which is a characteristic medical condition called palmar erythema. and pulmonary erythema occurs where the liver is not functioning properly, or is not able to release the toxins from the body, usually due to excessive alcohol consumption or pharmacological drugs. And in fact, that was actually what her problem was. She was being on steroids for a long time, and she was actually undergoing treatment with her naturopath to try and detoxify the liver and sort out some of those conditions. But so there are things like that which are very palpable ways in which you can detect physical suffering in this case from a hand, and you can advise and assist people to make their lives better. But I think it's also important to consider the psychological and emotional components as well. And I think most people who come for hand reading don't want to know whether their liver's working well or whether they're going to get Alzheimer's when they're older. They want to know things like, why can't I get a boyfriend? Or what job should I do? Or nobody understands me. What's going on? So it's kind of like answering those kind of core questions that people have, like, who am I? Why am I? Why do I do these things? What's going on? What should I do with my life? So you can detect people's skills and abilities. You can detect things like childhood developmental issues or trauma from the hand. I'm actually preparing a paper now, because I'm doing a workshop on Sunday on the indications of childhood trauma in the hand. And so you're looking at ways in which human experience manifests itself within the hand and causes particular behavioral responses in exactly the same way. For example, someone has a traumatic incident in childhood and it causes them to behave in certain kinds of ways, and their behavior is actually a manifestation of their trauma, and that could be inhibiting them from fulfilling their potential or doing other things in their life, because their life has been overtaken by those events and, if you like, derailed from what their intrinsic skills and gifts are. So it's not fortune telling.
Yeah, as soon as you see palmistry, I was taken back to this magic book I had when I was six, and I used to stare at the palm print and go, oh, I'm missing one of the lines. But now I have vague feathery bits where that line, what used to be missing. So yeah, the hands change. And can you really tell if someone's going to get Alzheimer's from their handprint?
It's a slightly funny story. My mother, who obviously I've read her hands a few times and taken her handprints, and in the early 90s, she sort of said, "I'd like, give me a hand reading. Tell me about my hand." And I said, "Oh yes, of course. Well, look at your hand. You've got a very long index finger. Shows you've got good leadership and management skills, and you've got a long airline. So you're very intelligent, articulate, and you know you're good at communication." She said, "Yes. I know all about that. But tell me something about my future." I said, "Mum, you know you can't do that from the hand. I've told you many times, it's the hand's not about the future. The lines of the hands change. They don't tell you about your future in that kind of way." She said, "Oh, go on." And I went, "All right, you've got 10 loops, Mum. You're going to get Alzheimer's when you're older." She said, "Oh, I didn't want to know that." And in fact, my mother did get Alzheimer's when she in her early 80s in 2017. She died 2 years ago as a consequence of that. So she spent the last 4 or 5 years with Alzheimer's. So yeah, you can, and that's a very personal example of which it could be seen from the hand. And that's as I said, that's nothing to do with chirology really. That's to do with medical dermatoglyphics. So the medical scientists who've done those research papers, and there were thousands and thousands of research into the genetic significance of fingerprint patterns, they come up with that information. The best example is Down syndrome. Down syndrome has been extensively studied by scientists. In the 1960s and 70s, there was a place in the UK where they could diagnose the likelihood of a couple producing a Down syndrome child by looking at the hands of the parents.
Wow.
This was before genetic screening could be done. This is in the 1960s and early 1970s. Lionel Penrose and Sarah Holt ran the Kennedy Galton Center for a dermatographic assessment, and that's exactly what they pioneered and set up. I mean, nowadays nobody does that, because we can do the more sophisticated chromosomal analysis, but it's actually possible. It was actually discovered how to do that in the 1960s.
Wow. And so those of us who have parents of that kind of age with a few short-term memory issues are busy looking at our fingers like I have been for the last 2 minutes going, oh, what was a loop again? And how many do I have? And will it affect me?
Well, and the thing to know about that, I mean, they've just been doing it on Alzheimer's, they're discovering it's, well, they're now calling it type 3 diabetes. But the point about that is that once you know something about the condition, you've got a genetic disposition to do that, then you can actually take steps to ameliorate that. So you can do the things that stop doing the things that make it worse and do the things that support the nervous system and slow down the rate of degeneration of the nervous system. We're all going to die of something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's quite, and so there's something empowering about knowing what you're more likely to suffer from and therefore learning the techniques you need to manage that. And so it is with psychological trauma. And so it is with skills and abilities. You know, a very good friend of mine who has a doctor and a midwife and has worked all her life in scientific worlds is an incredible artist. And it's quite clearly marked in her hands that she's got this amazing feature that shows that she's absolutely brilliant, inspirational artist. It's taken her 40 years of her adult life to actually get round into learning to paint because nobody encouraged her to do that when she was young because nobody saw that. Her father was a NASA engineer and whole scientific background and community that she grew up in didn't support her or endorse the artistic and the creative. And so I find that again and again and again with people. And one of the most common things that happens when I read the hands of older people, let's say 50-year-olds and above, some people on the other side of the midlife, they'll go, I wish someone told me that 30 years ago. It's a really common refrain from people. And it's not that we can't find out about ourselves through other means. Astrology is equally good, I think, and the various other modalities that will be helpful. And eventually in our life, if we're looking at all, we will discover something about ourselves. It's just hand reading is like, now you can find out now. You don't have to learn from experience. You can find out what you're like now. So I had my hands read when I was 20. I discovered hand reading when I was 20 years of age. And I had my hands read by a guy who was at that time the secretary of the Chirological Society. And it was life-changing. Because he was able to articulate to me the nature of my experience of my childhood. He was able to explain to me why I felt the way I felt and why certain things had happened in my life. And I say that, you know, that was the profundity of that experience was transformational for me. But I say that now, knowing that the hand reading that he gave to me in 1983 was actually terrible. And if he was one of my students now, I wouldn't give him a diploma. I would fail him, you know, as not being good enough because he really, by today's standards, I wouldn't say that he knew what he was doing. So I've been working very hard the last couple of years to kind of refine the knowledge that I have. And it's been a great, 2023 was a great year because four of my students have finally passed their diploma papers. So. So people say, well, how can you prove it? How does it work, this stuff? And I said, well, it's kind of easy. If I just give you an impression of a hand, of handprint, and I'm going to give this handprint to somebody, they don't know who it is, they don't know anything about the person, don't have their date of birth, they can't cheat by using an astrology or something like that. They've just got their handprint. They have to write a 2,500-word report on that person's hand. That 2,500-word report has to include a detailed psychological profile, an assessment of their personality and character and temperament, an outline of the kinds of skills that they've got and therefore the kind of work that they do, and should give some indications of either the job or the range of jobs that they've been involved with in their life, and should describe something of their emotional experiences, sexual preferences, relationship orientations, and probably therefore also some of the psychological traumas or experiences during childhood that have affected both of those. And if you can write a detailed report covering all those things, you pass.
So you're saying, I mean, just honing in on the one thing that really kind of stood out in what you said that they're writing about, Buddhist handwriting can show sexual preferences and relationships as well.
Yes.
And I'm going to segue because I want to hop over to astrology. Do you see that in astrology as well?
I don't think astrology is as good as hand reading. And I say that And I say that as a practicing astrologer. I actually did an astrological consultation this morning, and there is an enormous potency within astrology. And in fact, the woman who taught me hand reading when I first learned it, well, she also drew my chart up for the first time as well. So I actually learned astrology and hand reading at the same time. I started them together. The difference between them, there's two main differences which I'd like to articulate between astrology and hand reading. I think the best way to think about a chart is like an architect's blueprint of a building. It's like the building as it should be, if it's built perfectly and, you know, it's all been set up and there's consent being given and nobody's changed the plan. But as we know, houses get modified, they get extensions, they have conservatories put on, pop up the roof, whatever. The hand is more like the building as it is now, how it's evolved over life in that kind of way. So what I think when I'm looking at a chart, and whilst I agree extraordinarily, you know, someone with a moon Saturn conjunction in Pisces is going to have a particular kind of emotional orientation and emotional experience, which is completely easy to articulate. And the fact that person's going through their Saturn return now will mean that all those issues to do with the isolation and containment that Saturn conjunct the moon symbolizes will come to the fore. And so the pain and suffering around that will come out. So transits can give a kind of description of how that kind of personality has evolved. But I think the biggest problem that people have with astrology, and I think why it's easy for people to dismiss astrology, is they go, what's the connection? How does a planet up there affect me down here? Like, you know, how does that work? So people always want to know how it works.
The tides. The tides is always a good example. Like, it's run by the moon, not a planet, but is a celestial body.
It's actually not a very good argument, because scientists refute that one by talking about the gravitational pull of planets being minuscule, and therefore how could they produce those effects? So that one's particularly difficult one to support. But anyway,
for scientists, okay.
However we want to articulate that question remains and is a big stumbling block for a lot of people accepting astrology. Is like, well, what's the connection between this chart at this time and when I was born and me now?
Mm.
Great thing about hand reading is, well, there's no argument. You can't say, what's the connection between the hand and me? Well, it's on the end of your arms. It's like there is an immediate, tangible, and irrefutable connection between your hands and you. So then the next question comes, well, how does the hand show anything about personality? I mean, that's kind of like, that's predicated upon an assumption that there's no connection between mind and body, which hopefully some people have worked out isn't really true. That there is a connection between the two are interfacing together. But even if you look at the very fact that we can determine emotions from looking at people's faces, or we can determine genetic diseases from fingerprints and so on and so forth, it's quite clear that the hand is reflecting something of what it is to be a human being. And I usually answer that question quite sort of because that kind of question, how do these things work, is the kind of questioning that someone who's heavily invested in a scientific empirical paradigm wishes to look at. It's no good saying as above, so below to those people. That's a metaphysical assumption that which is inadmissible in the kind of empiric paradigm of scientific materialism. So if we're gonna offer an explanation to cater to that question, it's quite good to answer it in terms that can be understood. The thing that people don't know about hands is, well, first of all, fingerprint patterns don't change, and we know that, and we know that they're unique, and everyone has a unique set of fingerprint patterns. People do know that. What people don't know is that the lines change. So the lines are actually much more reflections of our experiences within life. And what's really interesting about the lines of the hand is they form in the hand of the fetus between the 9th and the 12th week of gestation. In other words, they form in the hand before the hand is capable of moving. There are no muscles in the hand. The hand, the fingers, there's no spontaneous movement of the hand being spotted in the fetal hand until about the 23rd week of gestation. So the fetus is not capable of moving its hand spontaneously for about 10 weeks after the lines have already formed in the hand. So the lines aren't formed by movement or activity of the hand. So then the question comes, well, what's going on between the 9th and the 12th week of gestation? Well, in terms of the embryogenesis of the fetus, what's happening at that time is that is when the nervous system is being laid down in the entire body. And what we know from looking at the lines of the hands is that the more lines someone has on the hands, the more anxiety, stress, and neurological energy they got, the more wired they are. And the simpler the hands, the clearer the hands, the more calm and sedated and still the person is. And what happens again is that as people go through periods of stress in their life, more lines appear. And as they go decrease from stress in their life, the lines fade away again. So the amount of lineation on the hand is a reflection of stress levels within the hand. And
yeah, should have taken a print of my hand before my long summer holiday.
Well, we think that probably the quickest change is about 6 weeks. I've got some handprints of a child whose handprints were taken about 5 months apart, which show incredible differences in terms of the lineation of the hand, which is attributable to things like that. But it's quite subtle things as well. I mean, I did a study a few years ago. Because I've been doing hand reading such a long time, I took a lot of handprints in like 83, 84, 85, and I still know a lot of those people because like in astrology, when you start doing astrology, you know, you take the charts of all your friends and people you know and your mum and dad and all that stuff, and you still know them 30 years later. So all those people I'm still in contact with, and so I was able to collect a lot of their handprints again. So I've got about 25, 30 handprints that I've taken, and about 20 of those are over 30 years difference in time. If you're interested in this study, I wrote it up as an article. It's actually on my website. And in fact, I gave it as a presentation to a conference a couple of years ago. And so there's an hour and a half lecture on exactly this topic.
Okay. If anybody wants to follow it, recover it.
in great detail, but it's all online. But in short, what was really interesting was looking at how the hands changed over time and seeing how they had changed. There were six women who I've known all my life, including my sisters, who basically went to university, graduated, got a professional job, whether it was working in television or working as a doctor, working in computer science, working for university admin, and have had the same job for 30 years, all got married, all had children. Those children are now grown up. They're still living in the same house with their same partner, doing the same job as they were 25, 30 years earlier. So interestingly enough, of course, their hands hadn't changed very much at all. But the difference was that there were certain linear formations on the tips of the fingers that had changed. And what was interesting about that, when I took all their handprints, they were all like 22, 23, 24. And when I took them again, they were like 53, 54, 55. They'd all gone through menopause. And they all had exactly the same linear markings on their fingers that indicated the hormonal and endocrinological changes that they'd been through in recent years.
Huh. Wow. Well, this is fascinating. Hand reading is clearly a topic that there's plenty to delve into. So should we hop over just briefly to astrology? I know that I wanted to ask you a bit more about hand reading because I know far less about it, but I'm also interested, and for our listeners, especially around this astrological midlife that this podcast is loosely based on, do you have any tips, tricks, like special things that people going into this phase or recently coming out, or, you know, in anything that pops to mind?
Yeah, I don't take it too seriously. don't worry about it.
Don't do a podcast on it.
Don't do a podcast on it. I knew, in knowing that this was the topic of the conversation, I thought I would actually check what happened to me when Uranus was opposing its natal position in my chart, which I take to be the most significant of the transits in terms of midlife crisis.
Yeah.
The Uranus opposition. And it was 2003, and it was like late 2003, and it was like, nothing much happened at all. Nothing of particular consequence of that. It wasn't any big revolution in my life. There wasn't any big change and transition in my life. Certainly not as big as when Uranus was conjunct my moon, which happens 5-6 years ago, which is when I got divorced. and separated from my wife, separated from my, left the home that I've been living with, broke up the family, of course, all classic Uranian symptoms of disruption to the moon, much to the chagrin of my daughter. My poor little moon in Taurus didn't enjoy that at all. But the actual Uranus opposition transit was, I would say, a complete non-event.
Really? And I think even by a slightly sporty looking car like I managed to do, but then I realized it was the beginning of my Uranus opposition when I did that.
not in 2003. No, I was my wife was pregnant with my daughter at that particular point.
Oh, so you birthday. Had a child. You had a child at that particular time. I would rate that as, you know, slightly life changing, having a child.
Okay. All right. Well, I maybe need to contextualize that then. I didn't have the child, so it wasn't quite so life changing for me in that sense. No. I already had one. But the way I'm contrasting it is by virtue of this. And for those of you who can't follow this astrologically, I apologize, but I'll try and explain it as simply as possible. In my natal chart, I have a Pluto-Venus conjunction in Virgo, opposite Jupiter-Chiron conjunction in Pisces. Square Mars, loosely conjunct the ascendant in Gemini.
Oh, yep, that's a good challenge for you.
It's actually the story of my life, and right, I think it's up again in later conversations, and I'll reference this again later on. Given the themes that Pluto-Venus suggests, given the themes that Jupiter-Chiron suggests.
And I just know that's going to be a good story, so hang in there.
Exactly. And with all apex square my Mars. So it's a T-square. So I've got a T-square apex Mars. So people often say to me, gosh, you're very intense and you're kind of quite aggressive and you're very assertive. And I go, I've got Mars conjunct the ascendant, like in Gemini. What do you want to do about it? You know, I'm sorry, that's what I'm like, but I'm not going to not be me. That's my energy, you know. And it's like, because it's in Gemini, it comes out as argumentativeness and it comes out on the ascendant. So it's very much bound up with my personality. Not going to apologize for that anymore. All right. So here we have five planets with between 8 and 13 degrees of mutable signs. So every time one of the outer planets has transited over between 8 and 13 degrees of Sagittarius, that's when my life has been completely disrupted.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
So when Uranus went over that point, that was when I was 20 years of age, and I went through what at the time seemed like a nervous breakdown. And it completely changed my life, because at the end of that process, that's when I discovered hand reading, astrology, meditation, yoga, and tarot. And I started doing meditation. I became a yoga teacher. I was a yoga teacher for 15 years. I started hand reading and astrology, which have stayed with me all that time. And I started all those five things within 3 months of each other in the beginning of 1983.
Okay, so what you're saying is don't sweat the midlife transits. You're going to have other stuff that's way bigger, and you might just be able to cruise through and surf through your Uranus opposition in midlife, which is what I'm discovering along the way, because I'm kind of nearly through and I'm like, oh yeah, okay. Have I figured it out? Well, it's just life. Just got to live it.
Exactly. It's no big deal. Like, I mean, I know people who've had Pluto-Saturn transits. I know people who have Pluto-Ascendant transits. Those stuff are big deal stuff. That's the big deal stuff. So it's more important, I think, to look at, this is what I teach when I teach astrology. I say, look, there's all this theory about astrology, but let's actually get real. Actually, what's the actual lived experience of doing astrology? But if you want to understand astrology, it needs to be something that you can relate to and actually have an experience of. If you have an experience of it, then it's valid. And you can know it. You don't have to believe in astrology. You either know about it because you've got an experience of it and you can understand the experience through an astrological paradigm, or you don't. But if you don't have the experience of it, it's almost completely irrelevant. And this is what I find when I'm teaching astrology, and I'm actually teaching astrology this weekend, an introductory course, day-to-day workshop. And it's like, and I really emphasize the lived experience of astrology. I mean, I've been doing astrology since 1983. I mapped my transits for my entire life in 1983-84.
Well, I
knew,
wow.
I I knew in 1983 that my life was going to change completely when I was 37 years of age.
And it did.
Which is 1999. And I knew that because in 1999, that's when I had Pluto transiting over the fourth leg of my T-square. I had Pluto square Pluto, Pluto square Venus, Pluto square Jupiter, Pluto square Chiron, Pluto opposition Mars, all at the same time in a 2 to 3 year period. And I knew my life was going to completely change during that time, and in a way that I couldn't either predict how it was going to go or what was going to happen. I did know is I would have to let go of everything, because if you know about Pluto transits, you have to let go of stuff.
So I suspect I know that that's a story that's going to come up because we've talked about bringing it in. But just before we get there, could you see in your astrology chart likely indicators of when the end of your life would be?
No, I haven't looked at that. But I kind of figure 76, 77, something like that, because of the age of my grandfather and the age of my father died. So I figure around that. And I'm probably going to have a heart attack or stroke because I've got world fingerprint pattern. So, I'll probably go out with a big bang around that age.
Well, don't we all want to die quickly? Yeah.
My mother didn't have that choice, unfortunately, but I've got different fingerprint patterns than my mother, so I know I'm not going to get Alzheimer's, so that's not going to happen. So
Okay, so back to the big astrological event when you were 37, tell us about it.
All right, so anyway, just to segue to that, so yes, just to reiterate your point, if people are looking for what are the more important things, time points in a person's chart, it's not Saturn return or Uranus opposition or the second Saturn return. Those things they're important milestones, and they're kind of evolutionary things.
And they're very Instagrammable.
They're incredibly Instagrammable. Totally, totally. Yeah. But what's much more important is when the outer planets, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, impact your personal planets, which is sun, moon, and I include the ascendant in that, or if you've got some aspect structure like a T-square where you've got a whole bunch of planets. So when I have a transit to that aspect structure, it's not just affecting one planet, it's affecting five planets simultaneously. And because that aspect structure is like essentially describing 50% of the forces within my consciousness, it's going to change absolutely everything.
And I knew this
was coming. What's that?
I've got 15 years of Pluto transits coming up in 10 years or so. And that'll
spark off
my grand trine. And yeah, but it's not a cross. It's not a cross. So
no, exactly. Well, the crosses and the oppositions just make it challenging. I mean, trines and sextiles, I think, just kind of, this doesn't mean it's not difficult, but it's like greasing the wheels. It just goes a bit more smoothly. But if it's an opposition or a square, it's a conflict.
It'll square your Uranus for 15 years.
Great. Well, but it's not going to square your Sun, Moon, Mercury, Venus, or Mars. It's personal planets. It's the aspects of the outer planets to the personal planets that are most impactful, in my experience. And I'm talking from experience. I mean, I literally, this is, So the context of that is I was practicing hand reading full time. I was the secretary of the Chirological Society. I was a yoga teacher. I was living a renunciate life because I was a Buddhist priest. I was a martial arts teacher. I ran a karate dojo in Oxford University, which I didn't charge any fees for that. And I didn't charge any fees for meditational practice and Dharma teaching that I taught. My only sources of income were yoga teaching, which was all by donation, and my hand reading work. So I was living this incredibly impecunious life, incredibly dedicated to this, to the renunciate lifestyle and doing all this yoga and meditation the whole time. So I kind of fully expected, okay, this probably means I'm going to go to Japan and go and, you know, live in a Zen monastery or something like that. You know, that's what's going to happen when this Pluto transits. My life's going to get uprooted and I'm going to go and do something like that. In the event of what happened, it was that I gave up being a hand reader, stopped being a yoga teacher, stopped being a Dharma teacher, got retrained as an IT consultant, moved to New Zealand, got married and started a family. So I did something completely the opposite, but completely revolutionary and completely transformational from the from what I had been doing before. But what precipitated that was the recognition, was the coming to understand that the man who was the leader of the Buddhist group that I was involved in there had been sexually assaulting various women. Two women were living at his temple and came to me to talk to me about how they'd been sexually assaulted by him. And it's not just sort of one-off incident, but how it had been going on for, in one case, a couple of years, and in the other case, about a year. And like they'd been completely trapped and unable to talk about it. And they were very isolated. And this temple was in a rural part of England. And we knew they were there, but we understood them as being students within this temple environment, and they were doing other sort of tasks, admin tasks and things like that. But basically, they were being regularly sexually accosted and pressured into having sexual contact with this guy. And it was in November 1998 that this kind of we were at a yoga seminar which I was teaching. And she came to me and was telling me this whole story, and I was like, the whole thing was just mind-gobblingly shocking. This was about November the 15th, and so I called a meeting of all the other senior people within the organization in early December, and it was like up, and I found a book that was incredibly helpful to me, and I always recommend this book. It's called Sex in the Forbidden Zone. It's by a psychiatrist called Peter Rutter. It was published in the early 1990s. It was available in 1995, and I got hold of this copy of this book. I found this book because I was trying to make sense of what I was being told. If this woman's telling me that our teacher has been sexually assaulting her, and hang on, you know, what's going on there? How do I deal with that? Is that so? I can't disbelieve her because clearly what she's saying is true. But if what she's saying is true, then what does that mean? Can I confront this guy? Can I talk to this guy? Can we resolve this issue? If I can, what's going to happen to me? That means he's going to reject me. Then I'll be out of the group. Then all these women won't be able to do anything and nothing will happen. And so I can't confront him about it. So if I can't confront him about it, what am I going to do about it? Do I just dismiss it and write and say, oh, no, you're just making shit up. No, I don't want to do that. There's a veracity to what she's saying. What do I do? And then this book, I went to this bookshop called the Inner Bookshop in Oxford, and I found a copy of this book and I read it in one evening. I then went back to the bookshop and bought the remaining 7 copies of the book from the bookshop. And I gave it to all these people, these other organizers within the group. I said, read this book. We're having a meeting about this on Saturday. They all read the book. They all went. And they all knew about the situation with these two women. Or they knew that there was sexual activity happening in that space, should we say. And this book basically describes, it's basically a psychiatrist's exploration of the problems of people in positions of authority and power having sexual involvement with people in their trust. So he's particularly looking at the relationship between psychotherapists and clients. But it could equally be between doctors and patients, or teachers and students, or facilitators and participants, depending on what you call it, where you've got a dynamic where there is a power differential. And in that power differential, that's where a lot of potency can happen. The therapeutic dynamic is basically based around the potency of that power dynamic. But in all of those professions, in doctors, in dentists, in psychotherapists, ostensibly in clergy as well, but in all the professional organisations, they have codes of ethics that say you can't get sexually involved with these, or in university lecturers and students as well, as another kind of, you know, in those kind of institutions, they have censure against that kind of activity. And if those kind of things happen, those people can be debarred, they can be stood down, they can have their licence taken away, and so on and so forth. So they actually have all those kind of institutions have ethical boundaries which helps to prevent that sort of thing happening. But in the unlicensed world of yoga, meditation, spirituality, conscious sexuality, for fuck's sake, all those kind of spaces, there is no licensing.
I have signed one for one of the studies I did, but we can come to that another time.
But yeah, well, that will but be
most that most don't.
Yeah, most don't. That's not, and it certainly wasn't in the 1990s. Right? No. You're talking now post Me Too. I'm talking 1998. I'm talking the same year that Monica Lewinsky was sexually assaulted by Bill Clinton in the White House.
Yeah.
Which she was gaslit for and has been gaslit for ever since. She was 22 years old. He is the most powerful man in the entire political world order with his finger on the nuclear button. And his semen stains are on her dress. He sexually assaulted her in the White House and then lied about it. And Hillary Clinton defended him. And that lie still stands as one of the most egregious examples of sexual assault in the history of American politics. So that was the context. I mean, and that we were dealing with. That was how little it was understood at that time. And so this book is revelatory because this book is actually, he was actually pioneering this discussion about what's wrong with that dynamic, what happens in that. And it's not an unusual thing. So if you look at the psychodynamic interaction, one of the concepts they have within that is this concept of transference. Part of that psychotherapeutic relationship is that the client will often project onto the therapist. And it's in that projection process that actually a lot of that healing work can happen. So the therapist is essentially there as a kind of a whiteboard to be projected upon. But that doesn't mean that she's in love with him. That doesn't mean she wants to have sex with him. And he needs to understand that that's not what's going on. And of course, what also the other phenomenon that occurs within that dynamic is countertransference, where the therapist projects back onto the client, and then his emotional and sexual needs are projected onto her, and that's when the trust is broken, because what you've got there is a delicate balance of trust. If that trust is breached, it is a total betrayal. It's a betrayal of the therapeutic relationship. It's a betrayal of her trust. And in the case where somebody has put their spiritual hope in a teacher, like if it's, I don't know, Satchinanda or any of these other people, Bikram, you know, anybody where you have a devotional relationship to like one of these flawed yoga gurus, what you also take away from in that person is their spiritual hope. You destroy their spiritual aspiration. It's an extraordinarily delicate and valuable situation that the therapists hold with the kindest, most kid gloves that they possibly can. And if they transgress that in any way, making a joke, making a comment about her hair or her clothing, or you know, even relatively innocuous things, let alone accidental touches on the arm or on the backside, or over intimate hugs, or all the right, going right onto kind of actual sexual assaults. You know, it doesn't matter how small the transgression is. There's a very thin line that's held in that space. It's incredibly important for that relationship to maintain its therapeutic quality, that boundary is not breached. And this guy, Peter Rutte, is the first guy to really explore that. And he talks about it entirely from his experience of clergy, experience of psychiatrists and doctors and psychotherapists. And he's outlining all of this. And when I read that book, that's when I knew what was wrong with the dynamic between the teacher and these women. Because he's in a position of power and authority and responsibility and trust. They have invested that trust into him. And he's created that relationship, and he's taken advantage of that vulnerability for his own sexual personal satisfaction, not for anything to gain. And one of these women was getting sicker and sicker and sicker as she was living in this temple. Because what happens in those kind of dynamics, it's kind of like an energy siphoning. These people literally suck energy out of people. They take their emotional energy, they take their sex, they're like hungry ghosts who need to be fed. It's essentially a kind of form of narcissism. And that narcissistic energy is kind of incredibly grasping and incredibly drawing, and it just draws this energy out of this person. So I came to realize that this guy that I'm was the head teacher was a fucking narcissist and a sexual predator. And then like, what the fuck are we going to do? So I convened this meeting on the Saturday, and fortunately, everybody read the book. So everybody read the book, everybody knew the situation, and everybody saw the situation, and they all went, we have to close it down. So this was like December the 8th. We closed down the entire organization, locked it up financially by January the 9th. We got everybody out of the organization.
Wow.
There was 153 people in that cult. We got all of them out. Everybody left. What people try to do in that kind of situation when they kind of see that going on is what they try to do, they try and reform the organization. They say, well, it's quite a good organization, but meditation practices are really good. I love the yoga, but you know, it's just, we've got to deal with his behavior. We've got to sort out his behavior. It's like, you can't sort out the behavior of somebody in an organization like that because it's their organization, because they made it. You can't reform a cult yoga group because that cult yoga group has been founded by the cult leader with all the charisma and the charm and the manipulation and the narcissism that's involved in that. The only thing you can do in that situation is to change it, is to actually walk away from it. But the only way you're going to change it effectively is if everybody walks away. Because the truth of the matter is, a teacher is only a teacher if a teacher has students. The teacher will always make it that the student owes everything to the teacher, and the student is nothing without the teacher. That's the languaging of those kind of dynamics. Anything that good that happens to you as a result of your yoga practice is because Iyengar is a fantastic yoga teacher. Anything bad that happens to you, because you're not practicing enough, you're not doing it hard enough, you're not doing enough of it, you need to do more. Practice and all will come. You know, so it's kind of like it's always the fault of the student. But actually the reverse is true. The teacher is entirely dependent on the students. And so it was that insight that made, okay, that's what we've got to do. We just have to get all the students out. If we get all the students out, then the organization will collapse because there's nobody to pay in for anything. There's no money coming in. There are no classes happening. No new people are getting drawn in. There's nobody doing the advertising. There's nobody running the organization. There's nobody doing the admin. There's nobody doing the banking. And so that's what happened. So we withdrew, got everybody out of the organization. And so it was functionally, it became defunct because by virtue of that. And this guy, his name is Terry Jukes. He actually died 6 years later of congestive heart failure. So he's the last 6 years of his life, he had nobody in his organization. And and so it was all over by 2005 because it was no possibility for it occurring again. But you can't reform organizations like that. And I think any attempt to try and reform a cult dynamic is kind of essentially not understanding what it is that you're dealing with. And so it's impossible to deal with us. It's exactly the same thing as you can't reform a narcissist. I mean, clinical studies of people with NPD, narcissistic personality disorders, where they get, you know, in prison situations, where they get lots and lots of therapy. The success rate for therapy for NPD, people with NPD, is about 5%. It's incredibly low. Mm. And so you can't actually, people with narcissistic personality disorder are really good at pretending that they've understood and really good at saying they've changed and taking on board all the characteristics that you want. In the meantime, you're just giving them all this time and energy trying to help them. And they're going, brilliant, I love it when you give me time and energy and try to help me. That's fantastic. It's exactly what I want. So you're actually giving them narcissistic supply. But they don't actually change, and they're not actually listening because they don't actually want to change, because actually there's nothing wrong with them, because actually they can't be wrong. And when you're in a situation of somebody, we've got someone with that personality who is also the head teacher of a Buddhist organization, where the head teacher's word is final in all matters, as it often is in those kind of charismatic cult situations, there is absolutely nothing you can do about it. So you can't argue with those people, and you can't debate with those people. You can't, there's no point in having a discussion with those people. You certainly won't change them by doing those things. In order to effect change in a space like that, you have to do something different. And my concern, my primary concern, of course, was the safety of the women. In fact, we did go to the police, and five women compiled reports which they gave to the police of their sexual assaults. We actually found 25 women had been sexually assaulted by him. In the end, the police investigation didn't go anywhere because the police officer, in Britain, they'd have to go to what's called the Crown Prosecution Service, who evaluate whether a case is likely to be successful or not. And they basically said a jury would not pass this because they'd say, oh, but they were over 18, they were consenting adults. And the point is, they're not consenting adults. So just to loop all this back together again, mm-hmm. and that's the really the most crucial and important point. In a relationship dynamic where there is unequal power, consent cannot equally be given. So if there's a power differential between Harvey Weinstein and an actress, she has much less power than him in that dynamic. It's much harder for her to say no, even if she's 33 or 44 or 27 and she's an adult. The power differential basically makes the possibility of consent, it's taken away from that equation. It's taken out of that equation because the power dynamic is itself gives a certain favor and authority to the person within power and no power to the person who doesn't have any power. Exactly the same thing as with a child. You don't sexually assault a child. You can't say, well, I asked this 5-year-old whether she wanted to have sex with me. Nobody says a child can give consent in that dynamic. You've got exactly the same dynamic. If you take Eric Berne's transaction analysis, the parent, adult, child, in a therapeutic dynamic, you've got parent and child. It's exactly the same model. Where there's an unequal power balance in the relationship, it's not possible for consent to be given. And if consent is not possible to be given, then what that means is any sexual connection to that person is a non-consensual sexual assault. Any act of sexual penetration in that situation is a non-consensual sexual act. And non-consensual sexual acts has a name: rape. And that is exactly what it is. When any teacher, facilitator, leader, mentor, psychiatrist, doctor, dentist, university lecturer has sex with a person, a woman usually, man usually male in those roles and women in the other roles, have sexual intercourse with somebody who is in a position of care or trust in relation to that person as a student or a participant or a patient or a client, that sexual contact is rape. And that's exactly what Peter Rutter explores in this book, because he basically says, why is it so devastating? This is not just like having a bad date down K Road and meeting some guy in a pub and you think, God, I wish I hadn't done that. I was a bit drunk. Oops, won't do that again. It's not that kind of unfortunate sexual encounter. This is a deliberately groomed sexual encounter where one person has power and can do what they want and get away with it and has enablers and bystanders who support and enable him. How did Harvey Weinstein get away with it so much for such a long time? It took 70 women to bring down Harvey Weinstein. How many women did not speak up? How many women in Hollywood didn't say anything? But 70 women to bring down one powerful man. And because the power protects those men, the nature of the patriarchal power structures within the misogynistic society with which we live, men are protected in that situation. And women are vilified. Women are called whores. They're called sluts. They're called out for the money. They're called gold diggers. They are vilified for it, for basically being in a position of powerlessness. The men in the position of power are the ones who protect it, as Bill Clinton was enabled and facilitated by Hillary, and still to this day is not being charged with anything to do with Monica Lewinsky. You know, it is the devastating effects that these actions have on women is undeniable. And I personally would argue that, I mean, I think, and this is not to trivialize sexual assault of any kind, and certainly not trivialize even random stranger rape, if such a thing really exists. But I think my observation and experience of women who've been raped, sexually assaulted by spiritual teachers, the level of devastation that produces is the next level worse. It's like absolutely destroys the core of their being, because it's not just taking away your faith in yourself or your hope for a relationship or hope for a normal life. It actually devastates people at a very core spiritual level. It can literally make people suicidal in the sense of there is absolutely no, it destroys people's spiritual faith, spiritual hope. That's how potent it is, and that's how devastating it is.
were the woman in the community that you all walked away from in the cult, I mean, presumably, well, they got on with their lives however they could. Did they walk away from that spiritual practice as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how about everyone else who wasn't involved with the abuse directly?
I can't answer the question for all 153 people. one of them was the woman I married. She became my wife, and she's the mother of my children. So I know that story particularly well. I've been in touch with a lot of these people subsequently over the years. It was quite important to kind of let the water go under the bridge and the time to pass. One of them was actually has subsequently, and I only discovered this a couple of years ago, been very involved in exposing the sexual abuses of Esther. And he's working with a woman in Holland, and they've written this amazing book called Red Flags in Workshops. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a really good booklet that describes, you know, this guy got involved with the neo-tantra, sexual tantra, conscious sexuality world. I mean, I haven't seen him for 25 years.
Of which Esther is part of it.
And I haven't spoken to him, so I don't know. But I was like, when I started investigating Esther and I came across this woman and I came across this booklet, I went, oh my God, this guy used to live with this guy. this guy helped me bring down the cult 25 years ago. So he's written this amazing booklet with this woman, this Dutch woman, about red flags in workshops, how you can tell whether, you know, there's consent going on, whether there's power dynamics, things to watch out for in behavior, you know, is there too much peer pressure, is there kind of, do you have tea breaks, are you got inadequate sleep, all the things, and you know, this is an orange flag, this is a green flag, this is a red flag, and how you can gauge it. So it's a really, really useful book. It's online, I think it's called, I'll look it up, but it's Red Flags in Workshops, I think, something like that. It's a really useful guideline book for people to know what is the nature of the organization. Are they going on a workshop, or they're joining a yoga group or something like that?
So when a community becomes a cult or potentially becomes a cult?
Yes and no. It's not kind of as simple as that. I mean, okay, I'll address that question because that is a really important question. I don't think it's as simple as that, because it's I think essentially all communities could be called a cult, and I don't want to get into that languaging because you know, Christianity was a cult when it started. I mean, that's exactly what the Romans thought about Christianity. So it's I don't think that's a helpful distinction.
Okay.
What a really helpful distinction is this, I think. I think the core thing, the difference between a community and a cult is a cult is based upon a lie. A cult is based upon a deceit. It's based upon something that's palpably untrue. So, for example, hi, I have connection to this this trans-Himalayan master, and he transmits data to me, and I have all these teachings that I want to relay to you because I have a special relationship with my invisible friend in the sky who lives somewhere in the Himalayas. Like, you know, I mean, there's lots of people who do that, but like, there's no verifiable basis for understanding where that is. Oh, and because I'm really important and I'm on a mission, it almost doesn't really matter what the lie is, but the point is, what the person is saying and what's actually happening are different. So take Esther, for example. It says, we are a sexual, shamanic, spiritual, neo-tantra organization. And they are none of the above. They're not tantric. They're not shamanic. And arguably, they're not spiritual. But they got advertising.
But sexual.
Now that was that. But the point is that they're tying one word, which is true, with three words that are not true. That's the lie. And that's the thing. Most cults will have some good practices in them, not because they're there to do with the cult, because they got them from somewhere else. And so if you look at Esther, for example, they use the Betty Martin Wheel of Consent practice. It's got nothing to do with them. They just nicked it from Betty Martin, you know, and they just incorporate it into their courses. So, of course, there are some good things. If it was all bad, nobody would go. You know, if yoga wasn't quite good for you, you know, nobody would do it. You know, if it was all kind of like working out like a boxer or, you know, something like that, you wouldn't get many people going to yoga classes, you know. So like, there's is exercise good for you? Yes, it is. Does this posture cure menstrual cramps? Probably not. I mean, Iyengar's Light on Yoga is full of preposterous and unverified claims about the health benefits of yoga. It's like the whole back end of the book is all about that. And it's like, but that's just Indian hyperbole. There's no medical data to support that. But that's the kind of the lie that we're talking about. So there's usually some good thing and it's wrapped up in a whole bunch of bullshit. And so, and when you've got that, what you've got there is the kind of, you've got an agenda, because what someone's saying something is and what they're doing it for are two different things. And that's the lie. And so one of the big things you see in cultic dynamics is something called cognitive dissonance. And cognitive dissonance is basically where you're told one thing and you're experiencing something else.
Oh, like the vaccine injured after the COVID vaccine?
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
Like the vaccine injured after the COVID vaccine, you were still getting medically gaslit.
I mean, there's lots of examples of that, you know, like... I mean, Rishi Sunak just did it in the UK. He just stood up and gaslit the entire population as being Islamophobes. You know, so it happens all the time where people are saying one thing and doing another thing. But that's where the problem comes. When you see, you know, you see someone like Bikram Yoga pretending to be Charlie Bikram being like a yoga teacher, and you know, he's like enlightened and spiritually aware and passing on this great yoga. He's on the run. He can't go back to America because he's being investigated for sexual assault and rape. He's a wanted man. He lives in Portugal, apparently. But, you know, he's still doing what he does. But there's a discrepancy between what he says he's doing and what's actually happening. Take the Osho compound in Oregon. What Osho said was going on and what was actually happening when they were poisoning local people and to try and get the vote so they could get on the local board, and they had guns in the compound, is completely different from the philosophy of love and peace and understanding. So where you get an idea that's one thing and the actuality is another, what you've got there is a dissonance, and that dissonance is basically based upon a lie. What communities have instead is a kind of honesty and truth. And what becomes really problematic is when you get situations where you have a really healthy community, but a really bad leadership. And a lot of cults are like that. So people will be in a cult and say, oh, but I really like the people. The people are really nice. I'm only going because all my friends are going. And I really like the sense of community in these spaces. And it's like, yeah, I get it. That's exactly what it was like in the cult that I was in. We all got on really, really well. That's what any Rajneesh will tell you that. You know, that's exactly what all the Hare Krishnas will tell you that. You know, people, community is a really, really important thing for human beings. People need that sense of belonging. And there's nothing wrong with wanting that. The problem is when that's not what the people who set the thing up want. If they're interested in money, or they're interested in becoming a billionaire, or they're interested in having sex with as many women as they can, or where they want power to manipulate people, or they just want to look good and be impressive and have a great Instagram profile. You know, there's all other sort of reasons that are going on which have nothing to do with that community. And unfortunately, people get involved with groups like that. You don't actually find out what's going on because you're not at the center. Most cults are kind of like a web. And I think most people can be involved in a cult for a short period of time and it'd be fine. You know, you go along and you do yoga and then you go, oh, I don't like the yoga anymore, stop doing it. You don't end up going to Bihar or whatever it is and getting more involved and wrapped up in it. You don't do the teacher training. You just go to a few classes a couple of times a week for a year. You'll be fine. You know, it's when you get more involved in something that you become part of the infrastructure of it and you get closer and closer to the center. And cults tend to be organized with the kind of the charismatic character at the center of it and everything else radiating out from that.
Community organizations also tend to be a bit like that. Once you get involved with organizing things, you're like, oh, it looked so much more shimmery and sparkly from the outside.
Yeah.
Because of human nature and working with people.
Exactly. So so the question there is to be discerning about those people. And you know, I was a scout leader for 10 years and I ran the scout group in Devonport. And grew the organization from 3 cubs to 126 cubs in a 5-year period. So I kind of very much you involved with that, but it's about the integrity of the people in that leadership role. Yes. And what they're doing it for. and why they're doing it. And that's a question of judgment and discernment about those people. But if you're on the periphery, you might not even know who organizes it. You may not know anything about the politics of the organization. You might not I don't want to get involved. Well, you are involved because you're supporting that organization, and you need to know what's happening at the center of it. Because if the person at the center of it isn't a Buddhist teacher, is committing sexual acts against the students, is lying about this, that, and the other, and isn't doing any of the practices, essentially not being the thing that that person represents, says that they are, then you're involved in a lie and a deceit, and you are supporting a lie and a deceit. So it's really important to look at the people at the center of these things and what their motivations are. And in a healthy community, there are checks and balances. And not just checks and balances within internally, but checks and balances externally. So in an example, like, you know, psychotherapists, if they have, you know, who are practicing therapists, they will have their own psychotherapist that they go to. You know, there is peer support. There's people that people can go and talk to and discuss situations or encounters. They got some accountability. So a really important red flag to watch out for is there any accountability? If there's no accountability structures within an organization, then that's definitely a red flag. And if any problem is dealt with internally, then it's a red flag. You know, it's like you can't expect people like Tri Ratna or Ista to reform themselves, even if they take a mediating group to reform themselves, if they're managing it internally because they've got their own internal blind spots.
I'm trying to think of a yoga organization or ashram kind of structure that has an external check. I mean, I am involved in a community that is set up so that the president has to be a woman. There's the management structure is mostly women, but mostly women are attracted to go to a place like that or be involved with those teachings because there is that sexual threat, the threat of sexual energy and power dynamics going out of balance.
I don't think there's no governing body for yoga worldwide. I mean, there's Yoga Alliance, but that's a loose affiliation. There is no governing body. I mean, yoga is a bunch of independent people doing their own thing, and now there's millions of them compared to how many there was when I was teaching in the 80s. So it's kind of like it's still a largely unregulated market, and in that sense, it's no different from any other enterprise. I mean, I think what I look at when I look at yoga, when I stopped teaching yoga in 1999, that was the same year that Bikram started his franchise. I cannot think of anything more disgusting than a yoga franchise. I mean, it's absolutely appalling. You know, it's like you're taking a sublime spiritual practice and you're turning it into a business. What the heck is that? You know, yoga was supposed to transform the West and make the West a better place to live. No, what happened was capitalism changed yoga and made yoga much worse. It was absolutely the other way around. What you've got is all the cultural appropriation and the making of money. You've just turned yoga into Lululemon yoga pants business. You know, it's just, you know, you're making money out of it. And that's a really good indication that something's not spiritual, I think.
I think Lululemon has actually changed to be more geared towards running these days.
Well, probably there's probably more money in it. But for me, that's a good green flag for a spiritual teacher, I think, you know, is to look at what their relationship to money is. I'm quite diehard in this way, in this sort of
you society. Definitely
I
mean, are.
What's that?
You are. That's a really good way of
describing. Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, if you're teaching meditation, don't charge for it. You didn't invent the meditation. You know, some bloke called the Buddha did 2,500 years ago. That got handed down through thousands and thousands of generations of people for thousands of years, and you are in the privileged position of being able to help people develop a mindful awareness of their own being. Brilliant. How honorable and fortunate are you? You fucking charge $20 for that? What? Or more? You know, you're making money out of something that is not yours to make. And it's not yours to give. That is theft. You know, and that is, and what it does also is it incurs a particular dynamic and relate. It commodifies spirituality. I think that's a really good way to look at someone's, have they commodified it? If it's being commodified, it's being denuded of any spiritual value. completely denuded of it. You know, it's the potency in a spiritual dynamic or an evolutionary dynamic lies outside of a financial transaction.
So these organizations that do a lot of free stuff and then reportedly they're actually being told in the background that they need to save other people to come around to their way of thinking and view of the world.
Yeah. Well, that's just manipulation. That's a lie, isn't it? So like, you've got saying we're not doing it for free. We're doing it for this reason. You know, it's like, let's give you free vegetarian food. Oh, no, but, you know, let's join a particular organization with a particular patriarchal misogynistic slant on how women should be treated, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you get sold into that's the lost leader, isn't it? That's the kind of like that's the draw card. That's the thing that brings people in. Every unethical group will have that draw card. It has its advertising agenda that it wants to draw people in, you know. So this kind of brings the question, like, so, you know, it's not just a question of buyer beware. I think that's a really important thing to emphasize in the context of cults and unethical yoga groups or any other meditation groups or any other organization. These groups do this deliberately. It's not an accident, you know. Cults thrive in situations where people are disenfranchised, have poor sense of community, have gone through some kind of trauma or some kind of difficult experience in their life, where they're feeling maybe a loss or a bereavement, where maybe an illness or something like that. They need help. They're looking for help. They're at their most vulnerable. And what they encounter is a group that's very friendly and loving and accepting, giving you free food and embracing and doing ecstatic dance and having cacao and all the different things that make you feel good. And you think, wow, this is amazing. I feel so good. And people want that. But the thing is, and there's nothing wrong with any of those things, except if they're being done for a different agenda and a different reason, which you don't know about initially until you get involved in it. And once you've been emotionally bonded by those kind of things, you feel an emotional commitment to those kind of groups. And what happens is people don't then investigate what is it this group that they got in, they're getting involved in. You know, I mean, there's people who in the group that I was in when we blew it up 25 years ago who still don't know what that group was about and you still haven't thought about it. And I know because I occasionally bump into them online. It's like, are you kidding me? You still haven't looked at it? But if you're involved in a group like that and you've got that position of in your life where you're feeling disenfranchised or sad or lonely and you want that community, that becomes really, really important to you. And that the overemphasis upon that emotional bonding, one of its effects is to diminish critical thinking. So one of the things I always say to people about these kind of things is you need to critically evaluate what it is that you're looking at. But in those kind of cultures, what you got, oh, you're being judgy. Or you're making judgments about people. You know, critical thinking is actually one of the most important faculties within spiritual evolution. It's actually one of the tattva. It's tattva number 15. It's called buddhi. Buddhi means discerning thinking. It's exactly the same word as Buddha. It is the most, and if you read someone like Christopher Wallace's Tantra Illuminated, he explains that this is the most revered quality, is the most important quality for a spiritual awakening is buddhi. Discernment, discerning thinking. But what happens when you get into groups where there's an overemphasis upon the emotional bonding and the emotional connection, that gets prioritized over development of critical thinking abilities. And when there's an absence of critical thinking abilities, then you don't see the signs. Oh, he's just being like that because, you know, well, that's just him. It's not really, it wasn't really sexual assault. That wasn't really harassment. That wasn't really him being narcissistic. It wasn't, you know, there's excuses for that because when it comes to looking at individuals' behavior, the cohesiveness of the group is prioritized over the behavior of the individual. But that individual is operating within the context of that group and in fact requires the cohesiveness of that group in order to function in the way that they do. I was at Ignition Festival earlier this year, one of the most consent-driven festivals that there is. Because, you know, it's a burner festival and consent culture is incredibly strong. One of the lead players in that scene, I witnessed one sexual harassment event in the entire week. I mean, I saw plenty of fornication in open spaces and lots of sexual activity all over the place. but only saw one non-consenting sexual harassment event occur, which I watched really carefully. And it's a guy who is very high up in that sphere and very high up in the New Zealand festival scene, who's well known and is well known for his predatory behavior. And he acts like he's above the law, but his ability to do that rests upon the cohesiveness of the group and everybody turning a blind eye to his behavior. And so because people will see him in a certain kind of way, they won't see what happens. They won't, oh, that's just him being him. You know, oh, boys will be boys, you know, oh, you know, he's a player, you know, whatever. All that languaging that women use about, watch out for him, he's got wandering hand trouble. That languaging that women use about men is essentially an expression of the rampant misogyny and sexual predation that occurs in almost everywhere. And since it occurs everywhere, why wouldn't it be occurring in New Zealand festival scenes? Of course it's occurring in those spaces.
So what the happened? Problem is,
in that particular instance?
In that instance?
I spent about 3 hours with the woman afterwards, first of all, regulating her nervous system, and then talking with her and her partner about what happened. And he said this guy had been pursuing her for 9 months.
Oof.
So it's been an ongoing predation of this woman. I saw it straight away. I didn't know about it. I'd never met her before, never met this guy before. And we had a 3-hour conversation about it afterwards, you know, because they're very distraught about it. You know? So this is happening in the New Zealand festival scene. And it's allowed to happen because in the same way that Harvey Weinstein got away with it for so many years. But it happens because people don't speak up. And then when they do speak up, people get shut down. You know,
so they're ostracized, right?
Or ostracized, exactly. And that doesn't matter whether it's a man or a woman that does that. You know, it's called silencing. If it's a woman, it's silencing the victim. It's like, oh, she's being hysterical. Oh, she's making stuff up. Oh, it wasn't that bad. It was just a joke. I was being playful. All the minimization things that men tend to do in those kind of situations that are actually gaslighting the woman and the seriousness of the offense and actually undermining her potency and her power and her trust. I know dozens of women who will not go to certain festivals because certain men are there.
Mm.
You know, same thing at Ignition. One of the first conversations I had with somebody I'd never met, there were three women having a conversation in a remote part of the field, and I was standing quite nearby, I was looking around, and they were having this conversation. This woman was really upset because an ex-partner or boyfriend or man who she'd had hassle with, who was assaulting her, was there, and she was felt really unsafe in the field, on the festival, because he was there. And I know other women who definitely will not go to certain festivals because they know certain people are going to be there.
It's not you just know, I know, you know, in other communities, people that won't go to events because of people that are there. Yeah.
Because of sexual assault, though?
Sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the point is it's there, and it's not acknowledged and it's not recognized. And I think part of that is because, I mean, we live in a culture that doesn't acknowledge and recognize sexual assault against women, how many rapes have occurred, how many rapes are reported and how many rapes are prosecuted. You know, all those kind of statistics are endemic in the society that we live. So, festivals are just a microcosm of that. And that's to be expected. But the point is that these are communities that are saying, no, we're doing it better. We are spiritual. We have values. We are community-led. We don't do alcohol. We do this, that, and the other, whatever it is. And yet these behaviors are still happening. And because these behaviors are still happening within the context of a presentation that says it's spiritual, it's holy, it's whole, it's good community, that's where the lie comes. That's where the cognitive dissonance comes. You know, I have absolutely no problem with the hedonism of Kiwi Burn or Ignition. I have absolutely no problem with that. I would actually have absolutely no problem with ISTA if it said, hey, we are an exhibitionistic, voyeuristic BDSM club. So if you want to come and have sex with 50 other people for a week, pay your money, we'll see you soon. If they advertise their product like that, I would have absolutely no problem with it. I probably wouldn't go, not my thing, but what there is an honesty about what they're doing. The problem is the lie. Oh, it's spiritual, it's tantra, it's shamanic. You know, it's not. And it's the lie that causes the problem. So when you ask what's the difference between a community and a cult, the difference is truth. honesty. You know, community, and a community can easily become a cult if it harbors people within it that behave in these unregulated ways where they think they're above the law, where they are behaving abusively, or they're extracting money, sexual favor, position, privilege, status, whatever they're doing. And that there's a, you know, all the human reasons why people put themselves in those kind of positions. You know, they, that's, you know, that the problem comes if those communities then support and endorse those behaviors. And I think people have to think really carefully about that and make, and have to be careful about the choices that they make, because, you know, they are effectively endorsing certain kind of attitudes and certain kind of behaviors. And I think that's very unwise. If it's something that we don't want to have in our community, if we don't want misogyny and sexual predation in our communities, in you know, whether we're living in Tauranga or Auckland, why would we tolerate sexual predation and misogyny within a festival scene that says we're trying to be different from regular society? Well, no, you're not. You're just being exactly the same. You know, Easter's no different. And the great thing about Easter is it's absolutely no different from any other capitalist enterprise that you might find in America. It's basically, how can we make the most money? What sells? Sex sells. Okay, let's do sex then. So how can we market sex in a way that's spiritual? Because if we market it as sex, people won't come. But if we market it spiritual, that means all the girls will come. Brilliant. What do we want to do? We want to get laid. Well, we're fantastic. We want to have an international lifestyle where we can live on yachts and travel. Brilliant. We'll run it in different countries all over the world. It's absolutely, absolutely perfect model for a philanderer's misogynistic playboy lifestyle. I mean, it's perfect, you know? And that's exactly what they've got. We just have a marketing problem. We just have to market it as something that people will want to buy. I know, let's call it neo-tantra, because neo-tantra is a way of saying sex is spiritual. And of course, neo-tantra's got nothing to do with sexuality whatsoever, as we know. So it's a marketing ploy, but the marketing is different from the actuality, and it's the deceit and the lie that makes it problematic.
And the marketing has brainwashed, I mean, the greater public would say, oh, tantra is something to do with sex, in the West anyway.
Yeah, well, you can thank Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh for that, and Yogi Bhajan. They're the two main progenitors of that since the late 1960s and early 70s. I mean, filters down into popular culture, you know. But
pretty much you just talked about, the abusers you talked about were men, so I feel better that the spiritual community that I spent an extended amount of time in was run by a woman, still is. Mm-hmm. And I went into it with Googling it, going, is this a cult? What is this? You know? Mm-hmm. So that critical thinking piece is really
it's good. I think it's important to look at what the criteria and where is it a cult? I mean, there's always arguments about cult. I mean, the technical term these days is high demand group. I would look at the claims of the teacher, if anyone wants a general piece of advice about going to yoga, if you're a woman, I would say go to a yoga class taught by a woman. So, like, let's just take that just takes one whole level of problem out of the equation straight away. You know, you're not going to get sexually predated upon, but you know, and it's not going to be the same kind of problem because it's not imbued with the same power dynamic. But anyway, that would be my first piece of advice, is like, and it's really weird how most people who attend yoga classes are women, and there are much higher proportion of men as teachers than there are students in yoga classes.
I've talked with other female yoga teachers and they're like, what is it? Like, the men get so popular. And I'm like, I know, I've been to classes with men, I've been to classes with women. There are a lot more talented female yoga teachers, but they don't get this same pedestal kind of,
it's called patriarchy. Yes. Just in a word, you know, that's, yes, in a word, you know, it's women are just as susceptible to that patriarchal model as men, but it would be better if it was more actively undermined, I think, particularly in the yoga sphere, where the majority of people who go to yoga are in fact women, you know. So but I think it's a false thinking to think that women can't be cult leaders. I mean, the most famous cult probably is the one that Christopher Wallace was initiated into, which is the Siddha yoga cult. So that was initially set up by Swami Muktananda, who was a sexual abuser, and it was taken over by Gurumaya Chidvilasananda, who was absolutely renowned for her bullying behavior. And she was the person in charge of Siddha Yoga when Wallace was there. And there's a guy called Daniel Shaw that's written extensively about the psychodynamics of Siddha Yoga and the abuses that went on at the hand of Gurumaya Chidvilasananda. He's a psychotherapist and he's written this fantastic book about it. He was there at exactly the same time that Wallace was. So it's quite clear that Wallace was in a cult at a time when it was at its most culty.
A spiritual teacher.
Yes, exactly. Question marks there. What did he learn in that ashram? I wonder. So what you've got to look at. It's a good case in point. Like, what is someone's background? You know, if someone's been in a cult, have they done any decult programming? Have they done any cult survival technique stuff? When I left the cult in 1999, a whole bunch of us went for counselling with the Cult Information Centre in London. And that was a really important part of the therapeutic process that we went for. But if someone's been in a cult and doesn't even admit that they've been in a cult, there's something problematic there. I don't know anybody who's been in a cult who got out of a cult by not admitting that they'd actually been in a cult. You know, it's like an alcoholic saying, how could somebody stop being an alcoholic without actually admitting that they're an alcoholic? And that's the whole basis of AA, is exactly that same idea. There has to be the recognition that the group you're in had unhealthy power dynamics within it. And those unhealthy power dynamics may not be sexual. They could be to do with psychological coercion, they could do with belittling, they could do with gaslighting, they could be to do with just creating a dynamic where the guru is right and the student is wrong, where the guru is pedestalized in that kind of way and the student knows nothing. And tithing, that's an incredible...
Tithing.
Financial abuse is essentially you're giving money for this and then it gets spent on that. You know, you're giving money to Destiny Church, but then Brian Tamaki suddenly becomes really, really rich. Like, what happened? You know, like it's like you think you're giving it to the community, and then one person ends up with 80 Rolls Royces. It's like, well, hang on a minute, how did that happen? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the lie again. That's about the lie. It's the con. You're being conned out of your money because what's happened to your money isn't what they say it is. And often these organizations don't have transparency around their finances. A lot of religious organizations are tax-free and tax-exempt. And so they can get away with this kind of stuff because they're not audited in the same kind of way. So, and the smaller organizations are even more so that's true. Or an international organism such as ISTA doesn't have any centralized thing and is completely financially unaudited and has been for 15 years. So where does the money go? You know, the money goes somewhere. That's the financial extortion that happens. So, and these are not the questions that people ask when they join their yoga class. They don't go, hi, can you tell me where the money goes? Hi, you know, who was your teacher? Hi, were you ever in a cult? Have you ever done any cult recovery program? But I think those are kind of the interesting things, good things to look out for. Has the person made up some story about their background? So most gurus or leaders they're very good at creating a narrative story about how brilliant they are, how amazing they are, and they kind of got this hagiography that actually has nothing to do with any historicity at all. And so you get this kind of disparity between the presentation and the actuality. Clearly, that's part of the pedestalization process. They often adopt a name that isn't their real name. That's another really good example of doing the same thing, because it's like separating the person, the human being that was born of a womb, into the teacher, who has these special qualities and powers. And so you can't refer to this teacher by their birth name because they get insulted. I mean, the teacher I was involved with was called Shifu Nagaboshi Tomio no Otomo. That was his pedantic made-up name, which he gave to himself. Which it always pissed him off when I called him Terry Jukes, because that was his real name. That was his name that his mother gave him. You know, so it's a really good thing. You know, I would never call Christopher Wallace Harish.
In some of his online stuff.
Do you know who gave him that name?
Osho? Rajneesh?
No, Muktananda.
Muktananda. Because he's from Siddha Yoga, right?
Explicitly, every time he calls himself Harish, he's saying, I am acknowledging Muktananda, serial sexual abuser, as my teacher. I feel it important to be associated with this man because he gives me power and authority. Never mind, maybe he didn't really sexually abuse people. It's kind of like, it's hard to say, you know, it's one person's word against another. And anyway, spiritual experiences, they're not always what they seem to be. Literally, he has said that, and I can send you the video clip of that if you want, but it's like he has an extraordinary evasive justification around that. But either way, it's the only name he's got, so that's the one he uses. But it's like, I find it really weird. And I have a Buddhist name. My Buddhist name is Prajñacitta. You know, that's my Buddhist name. I never use it, you know, that because that was given to me by my sexually abusive teacher. Why would I give him the credit for that? You know, that's like honoring a relationship with a man who's dishonorable. I would never do that. That's really weird to do that. It's like, why? Well, because it gives me power, authority, makes me sound amazing. You know, Heart of Wisdom, what a great name. Wow, wonderful. You know, it's like, you know, it's very flattering. It's an elevation. It's about self-prominencing. And that's another thing to look for. What way does the person self-prominence in that kind of way? Because it's, you know, and that's the problem about business again. If you're a business person, you're trying to make money, more self-prominencing, the better, because you get the more you kick the algorithm and you get more clicks and you get more ticket sales. You know, so it's, but humility, you know, the most important spiritual teachers in the world, you've never heard of them.
Absolutely. So we have covered an awful lot. And I'm sure we could keep talking for much, much longer. If people want to know more, either about the Buddhist hand reading, assuming that the people that listen to that part have made it to this far, astrology, or even more on, have more discussion on community, cult, sexual abuse and the like, how can people find you?
You can phone me up, you can send me an email. I've got a website, handreading.nz. I've got Facebook page, handreading.nz, and I've got Instagram page, handreading.nz. So that's all pretty straightforward. And I've got a YouTube channel which I started last year, which talks a lot about handreading. Somewhat pretentious title of master hand reader, but after 40 years I think I deserve it, so I thought, why not? There's so many Mickey Mouse hand readers going around out there who really don't know what they're talking about, and most of the good ones out there are people who are students of mine that I taught 30 years ago, so I feel like there's some honor to be had in that. I wrote a book called The History of Hand Reading. It's a 65,000 word essay basically on why chirology isn't palmistry and the history of palmistry and the history of chiromancy, and I wrote it in 1990, between 1992 and 1994, and I put it online in 2001. It's been online since 2001. It's a free download that anyone can get to read, so there's no excuse for anybody ever to claim that hand reading is to do with fortune telling and prediction and that's all this gypsy stuff that happened in the 15th century. Some guy in Russia in 2018 downloaded it and translated it, and it has been sold in Russia. It's been printed as a book in Russia. I found this out last year. One of my books has been translated into Russian. I'm apparently really famous in Russia, like the hundreds and hundreds of copies. You didn't
get any money from it, huh?
But I didn't get any money from it. But that was fine because, you know, it's a gift. It was my gift to the world is that particular one.
Okay, One
more thing, in terms of the other things that we talked about, I'm really happy to talk about stuff about cults with people. I've done a lot of pro bono work on that. I did about a year and a half, 2 years with the Kundalini Yoga, Yogi Bhajan Kundalini Yoga Abuse Support Group, which came out when Premka's book came out in 2020. I did a lot of work with Carolea Grant, actually, exposing various yoga cult leaders like Rod Stryker and Mark Whitwell, and she wrote some articles about those. So it's something that I seem to have a lot of knowledge about because it's something I processed a long time ago, you know, 25 years ago. It was very interesting working with the Kundalini Yoga Group because I was talking to them about stuff and helping them process the getting out of the cult thing. And they found what I was writing really, really helpful. And I eventually posted an article, like a little essay, like a story really, that I'd written in 1999. And I posted it on their website. And the response I got was amazing. Oh my God, that's exactly what Yogi Bhajan is like. That's exactly what it's like in Kundalini Yoga. And I had to tell them, I said, it wasn't about Yogi Bhajan, it was about my teacher. And all these people in the Kundalini Yoga, they'd all assumed that I'd done Kundalini Yoga. They couldn't believe it. I said, no, I've never done it. Never been to any Kundalini Yoga class. They said, well, how do you know? How do you know it, sir? Because cults are cults. Cult dynamics in one cult is exactly the same as a cult dynamic in another cult. Narcissistic abuse in one situation is exactly the same as narcissistic abuse in another situation. And if you recognize the pattern, you can see it everywhere. And I'm very happy to talk to anybody who wants to see and undo those patterns if that's what they're experiencing.
And one last question I have to, because I will put it in the introduction. You've used a term that I'm not familiar with about hand reading, and you've said it very fast. Could you just say something?
Chirology.
Chirology. Thank you.
Chirology. Like chiropractor.
Yes.
It's the same word. Chiro means hand. So chiropractor means practice with the hands. Chirology is kihere logos, the study of the hand.
Great, thank you. That clears that up.
Etymology is very, very helpful.
It really is. It really is. Why don't they teach Latin anymore?
Exactly. Yeah, it is.
Thank you, Christopher, for sharing your knowledge and thoughts with us today.
Thank you for having me, Sarah. It's been a pleasure. It's been very, very enjoyable. Thank you for having me.
If you got this far after the longest podcast I've ever recorded, well done. Today's music is a throwback to when I was living in Aoraki, Mount Cook many years ago, and has absolutely nothing to do with cults or hand reading, apart from the fact that I had hands when I wrote it. In fact, I still do. This is Seeking Peace, previously unreleased.
Onwards we move, getting older and wiser, and looking forwards and backwards with abandoned detachment. The plants here will flower and then produce fruit. I realize that moments in life are about play. Looking back on the days of maturing and learning, appreciating the wisdom that came in all of its forms, its humanity's journey, I go seeking peace. It'll lose me at first, sometimes I find it. When the earth is at one with itself, Aoraki stands strong. The kereru fly by and the kias squawk loudly. What a magical morning, and I look over the valley and over my life. Looking back on the days of maturing and learning, appreciating the wisdom that came in all of its forms, its humanity's journey, we go seeking peace. It eludes me at first, but sometimes I find it. Yeah, I find it. I can see through the trials that life always presents us. That light at the end of the day pass over the stresses and toils and pain. Live through it and perhaps, just perhaps, we shall learn vital lessons. Looking back on the days of maturing and learning, appreciating the wisdom that came in all of its forms, its humanity's journey, we go seeking peace. And it eludes me at first, but I know I can find it. Yeah, I can find it. I can find it.
Unraveling Midlife is brought to you from Aotearoa New Zealand by www.sarahmarlowspence.com. Theme music is by Sarah Marlow Spence and Saraswati Marie Willis, and art by Samantha Hepburn.